substantially overrun by jungle were first seen in the 1500s by Spanish explorers. Not until the early 1800s, however, were efforts made to study these ruins. In 1843, the American travel writer John Lloyd Stevens published the first of several treatises on his explorations of the region. He wrote of the solemn stillness of the woods, the desolation of the ruined cities, and the mystery that hung over them. Within 3 months, his book went through 12 editions and sold over 20,000 copies. 70 years later, one of the book's most avid readers, a young archaeologist named Sylvanus Gorley, convinced the newly formed Carnegie Institution to begin the study of the Mayan ruins. Carnegie's division of historical research was one of six Carnegie departments that do not survive today. His department was active from 1905 until 1958, during which time it sent dozens of expeditions to the Central American jungles and fostered the careers of many illustrious Mayan scholars, including that of Sylvanus Morley. In his time, Morley was regarded as one of the foremost authorities on Mayan culture. His interpretation of that culture remained the dominant view until the 1970s, when new scholars began to re-examine the mysteries of the Mayans. One of those scholars is our guest tonight, Dr. Jeremy Savlin. While traditional Mayan scholars tended to focus on the Mayan elite and the temples and other ceremonial structures they built, Dr. Savlin and his colleagues took a broader and more inclusive view. Their goal was not so much to find beautiful objects as to determine how the Mayans, with their Stone Age tools, were able to transform the Central American jungle into a complex civilization. Dr. Savlin was a leader in this work and made seminal contributions to studies in Mayan urbanism and settlement patterns. He has also made major contributions to study in archaeological theory, method, and history. Dr. Savlin is the Christopher H. Brown Distinguished Professor of Anthropology at the University of Pennsylvania and a curator of Mesoamerican archaeology at the university's Museum of Anthropology and Archaeology. He's a member of the National Academy of Sciences and the American Philosophical Society. He is a fellow of the American Academy of Arts and Sciences, the American Association for the Advancement of Science, and the Society of Antiquaries in London. He is a member and past president of the Society for American Archaeology, a past editor of the journal American Antiquity, and he currently sits on a number of editorial boards and visiting committees. He is also a senior fellow and former president of the Kolb Foundation and the former chair of the Smithsonian Science Commission. He has written numerous books and articles about archaeology in general and the Mayans in particular. He has been instrumental in making the Mayan culture relevant to us today. It has been many, many years since a Mayan scholar has graced this room. Please join me in welcoming Dr. Jeremy Savlin.
Sir, you're certainly welcome. Draws hands it to him. The archaeologist goes near the entrance, and pretty soon his colleague walks in. She also has a dog, and as she comes in, he whispers to her, tell the bartender it's your seeing eye dog. And so she walks up to the bar and orders a beer. He looks at, ma'am, you just can't do that. We don't allow dogs in this bar. And she said, it's my seeing eye dog. And he said, it's a chihuahua. And she goes, they gave me a chihuahua. There are two morals of the story. One, the obvious one, is archaeologists love their beer. But more relevant for us tonight is that archaeologists are adaptive. And it's the second moral that I would like to take as my theme this evening. More specifically, how Maya archaeologists have adapted their models of ancient Maya civilization to the new data and understandings that have emerged rapidly in recent years. This is really an incredibly exciting time in Maya archaeology. So much is changing so rapidly in our understandings of this ancient civilization that it's difficult for a specialist in Maya studies to keep up with the field, let alone the general public. For many years, what I've termed the traditional model of Maya civilization has held sway. Based on pioneering archaeological research in the Maya area, which includes the southern part of modern-day Mexico, Guatemala, Belize, and the northern parts of Honduras and El Salvador, this work, principally by our host tonight, the Carnegie Institution of Washington, mainly from the 1920s through the 1950s, this traditional model was codified by Carnegie scholars and principally the two leading Mayans, one of which Dr. Nzervas already mentioned, Sylvanus Morley, who we see on the right with his wife, and Eric Thompson here on the left with his wife, a picture taken in the 1930s at Chichen Itza. The traditional model was communicated to the public in two books that Morley and Thompson published. Morley's The Ancient Maya, which has been through numerous editions, the first one in 1946, and Thompson's The Rise and Fall of Maya Civilization. His first edition was in 1954. In fact, that was the first book in Maya archaeology that I ever read when I was in graduate school in the 1960s. The major focus of attention in the Morley-Thompson traditional model was the classic period from about 300 AD to 900 or 1,000 in time. And the southern Maya lowlands, the tropical rainforest core of the greater Yucatan Peninsula in space. In particular, the principal focus was on the elite, their architecture and art, their burials, their tombs, their ceramics, and other exotics such as jade, and so on. The wonderful artistic output of the Maya, as well as their architecture, was the focus of much of this archaeology. Based on this limited focus, the prevailing view held that the classic Maya developed peacefully in their jungle stronghold, generally isolated from their Mesoamerican neighbors to the north in Mexico, to the south in lower Central America. The classic rulers lived in non-urban ceremonial centers. This is the wonderful Tatiana Perskurikov view of the Copan ceremonial core. They lived in these non-urban centers with the farmers who practiced a shifting slash and burning agriculture and raised maize, beans, and squashes in their fields, providing the food and labor for the relatively small number of elite rulers who lived in the huge palaces in these centers and worshiped in the large temples. The specialists who worked for the rulers carved inscriptions on stone monuments that spoke of the gods and the sacred calendar. The rulers and their extended families had highly sophisticated knowledge, as Dr. Mazur was mentioning, of astronomy and mathematics. They had a very accurate 365-day calendar. For reasons that remained unclear, or at least about which there was no agreement, classic Maya civilization rapidly collapsed in the 9th century AD. And following this collapse in the southern part of the Yucatan Peninsula, remnant centers slowly declined for a half dozen centuries until the arrival of the Spanish in the 16th. In the northern lowlands, there was a brief fluorescence at the end of the classic period, first among Fuk region sites such as Uxmal in the upper left, Labna towards the right, Sayil, here down in the lower left-hand corner, a site where my colleagues and I worked in the 1980s, a major project supported by the National Science Foundation. These sites flourished around 800 to 900 AD, also Chichen Itza, which continued on into the early post-classic period. The latter stimulated in part by a takeover of the Toltecs in central Mexico, it was then believed, followed by a decadent period in the late post-classic, which witnessed the rise of the Mayapan Confederacy, its densely occupied capital city, studied by the Carnegie Institution of Washington in the 1950s, which had more than 12,000 inhabitants within its wall, and which declined just before the Spanish conquest in the 16th century AD. But neither Chichen Itza nor Mayapan, it was maintained in the traditional model, was able to reclaim the former glories of the classic period. The quality and later the size of monumental architecture in the post-classic declined. Typical late post-classic structure, note the uneven stonework covered by a thick coat of plaster, as did many other of the fine arts, particularly painted ceramics, which became much simpler in the post-classic. The post-classic Maya virtually ceased carving inscriptions on stone monuments, and many other material hallmarks of the classic period faded away. As Tatiana Puskurikov famously stated about Mayapan, which flourished between, say, about 1250 and 1450 AD, quote, "The fall of Mayapan appears as a dramatic culmination of a long process of cultural decay," end quote. This traditional view of the ancient Maya has really had remarkable staying power. So it should not be surprising when you ask someone, what do you think of when you hear the term ancient Maya? I do this often with my freshman courses. It's no surprise that the answer is often temples, palaces, tombs. Or perhaps, for someone who's read a little more, they might say, great achievements in science, art, architecture, and writing. But almost certainly, the answer is not going to be dense urban centers, sophisticated manipulation of the environment, thatched roof houses, peasants, craftspeople, and so on. If there's one word which you are certain to hear, and Dr. Reserve has already mentioned it, it's mysterious or mystery, as in the mysterious Maya or the mystery of the Maya collapse. I hope to show you this evening that while many questions about ancient Maya civilization remain unanswered, the traditional use of mysterious, fortunately, is not warranted anymore. However, it certainly doesn't mean that the study of the Maya is any less exciting or any less romantic than in the past. If anything, I would argue that it is more so today than ever before. In addition to the specifics of the traditional model, it was also characterized by certain attitudes. Let me mention just two important ones this evening. The first was that ancient Maya civilization was very different from other pre-industrial civilizations, the Sumerians, the Egyptians, the Inca, or the Teotihuacanos and the Aztecs of central Mexico, and so on. In other words, it was generally held that Maya civilization was unique. The second, in keeping with the general intellectual tenor of the times in archaeology, was a concern with trying to answer what are often being called the what, where, and when questions about the ancient Maya, with little interest in how and why questions, especially relating to the development of Maya civilization through time. As many scholars have argued, by the 1970s, traditional Maya archaeology and its models of the development of Maya civilization began to change significantly. There are many reasons for these changes. Generally speaking, the number of field projects increased significantly. There were more rigorous research programs and thus better field data. And new methodologies and new field techniques were introduced, resulting in new and certainly much deeper and better kinds of data. Moreover, breakthroughs in the decipherment of Maya hieroglyphic inscriptions added a rich new historical context for classic Maya civilization and new understandings of Maya politics and ideology. So let's look at some of the tenets of the traditional model and see how our understandings of Maya civilization have changed. The first, as I've mentioned, and perhaps the kind of major tenet, was an emphasis on the classic period from about 300 up to 900 or 1,000 AD. This dominated Maya archaeology. This is the time, say, of the height of architectural, artistic achievements, and
the classic, and then, as we'll see, the post-classic as well, after the collapse of the classic Maya civilization in the southern lowlands. New information about the pre-classic indicated that, in fact, the roots of Maya classicism go back centuries before it was previously known, and in fact, the beginnings of really major monumental architecture complexity go back 500-600 BC, in effect, 700-800 years before it was traditionally felt that Maya civilization began. And we'll also see that the post-classic was much more complex than anything that had been thought of during traditional thinking up until the 1970s. The second tenet of the traditional model was the focus on the elite, the rulers, and their achievements. Now, in the 1950s, particularly the work of Gordon Willey at Harvard and then many of his colleagues, focused on these modest little mounds that you see here, in this case in the Belize River Valley, instead of the great temples and palaces. Willey and his colleagues, excavating and mapping these, found that these mounds actually were the remains of perishable houses, and the analogy was drawn to modern Maya houses in Yucatan, in the highlands of Guatemala and Mexico, that were often made of wood and thatch. Of course, these disintegrated through time, but the small foundations would be left. And beginning with this work in the 50s, and this has grown throughout the decades since, my archaeologists have begun to map and examine these remains as frequently as the traditional archaeologists looked at the great temples and palaces. And as a result of these kinds of thinking, we found that the Maya centers were not small, vacant centers at all, but actually were major urban cities. This is just an example from the site of Tikal. This is downtown Tikal, if you will. The opening photograph actually was of Temple 1 here. This is the large temple palace complex. All these little rectangular boxes you see here, in fact, are the remains of complexes of perishable structures. This is that center, and they went out further several kilometers each direction and found that sites like Tikal had significant populations. Tikal may have had upwards of 40 or 50,000 people living there at around 700 AD, and comparable figures were found at other major sites. which were incredibly rich, which you could cultivate year after year, and in fact often double crop or more, and this could provide a much richer agricultural yield than it previously been felt, so that these larger populations that my archaeologists were recovering, that they could at least explain how they would be fed. And these were fairly early developments. Large interest in water control also was found in this kind of work. Another tenet of the traditional model was that the Maya were isolated in their jungle heartland. But now we know, with a lot of new work, that the Maya were definitely embedded in a larger Mesoamerican civilizational sphere, politically, economically, ideologically, particularly close ties with Central America, the Central Mexico, the Blue Area here, and specifically close ties with the great city of Teotihuacan. I used to say outside the limits of Mexico City. With modern-day Mexico City, that's not possible anymore. But in the northern reaches of Mexico City, one of the great cities of ancient Mesoamerica, in fact, one of the great cities in the world at about 400 or 500 AD, it was probably one of the two or three largest cities in the world at that time. Teotihuacan spread its influence politically and economically and had close links with the Maya lowlands. At Tikal, for example, this is Stela 31. The ruler there is shown dressed as a Central Mexican, and in fact, the figures on the side are Teotihuacan-like warriors. The nature of the interaction exactly between Teotihuacan and Tikal is a matter of some debate among archaeologists. Did Teotihuacan conquer sites like Tikal? Was this just economic interaction and so on? It's still certainly unclear at the moment. But we also understand that the interaction was two ways. This is a vessel that you would find in the Maya area that looks like it could have been made in Central Mexico, but actually was manufactured locally, was an imitation. But we also see classic Maya influences throughout Central and Northern Mexico as well. In fact, even later on, we now understand that the Toltecs probably did not invade Chichen Itza in the northern lowlands at around 900 AD at the end of the Classic period, but that this was a time when influences were flowing back and forth. But clearly, the Maya were not isolated at all, but were embedded politically and economically in a much larger sphere. We also now know that the traditional tenet that there was really a kind of a homogeneity across the lowlands, that sites were very similar, does not hold, again, in light of major new data, which indicates a great deal of variability among the many Maya cities in a variety of ways, and that we need to understand the variability of Maya civilization, not see it as a monolithic culture that stretches across the Yucatan Peninsula and adjacent areas. Another tenet that has really changed significantly is that hieroglyphic writing has more than just esoteric content. It was held traditionally, particularly by really major scholars like Eric Thompson, who worked for the Carnegie Institution of Washington, and others, that Maya hieroglyphs really were the sacred writing, talked about deities, the sacred calendar, and so on. And as one of my colleagues has pointed out, if you look at Thompson's writing, you can see how firmly he held that view, but also with the changes in understanding of Maya hieroglyphs, how he had to significantly alter his perceptions. Let me just give you one quote from a major book on Maya hieroglyphic writing that Thompson produced in 1950. And he writes, quote, "It has been held by some that the Maya dates recorded on stela, on monuments, may refer to historical events or even recount the deeds of individuals. To me, this is a possibility that's well nigh inconceivable. The dates on stelae surely narrate the stages of the journey of time with a reverence befitting such a solemn theme. I can
well be that Tatiana Proskurikoff's papers will lead me to revise my views on the impersonality of the text on Mayan monuments. And in 1971, 21 years after the first quote, Thompson writes, quote, work has shown that the generally held view to which I subscribe regarding the impersonality of the text is completely mistaken, end quote. But I think quite generously, Thompson quickly realized that the well-nigh inconceivable was in fact quite conceivable indeed. And with this change, rapid new understandings emerged about particularly the classic Maya period at the time of most of the hieroglyphic inscriptions. I'll just show you this one example here from Yaxchilan, two different lintels from a small temple structure at the site along the Usumacinta River. They show a ruler, Itzamnaj Balam II, who lived from 681 to 742 AD, also sometimes called the Heel Jaguar. Here's his name glyph in one ceremony here that took place in 709 AD. Lady Shoke, his wife, here's Itzamnaj Balam. Lady Shoke, next, she's drawing blood from her tongue using a rope with thorns. And the blood is falling onto bark paper, which eventually, from others, would have been burned, the smoke going to the gods as part of the ceremony. And this one's somewhat later, in 724, in fact, February 12th, 724, because we can correlate the Maya calendrical dates with our own today. Lady Shoke is handing a jaguar helmet in a ceremony to Itzamnaj Balam as part of an important ceremony. Whether he's off to go to war or not is a matter of some debate. But we start learning about the rulers, how long they reigned, where their family members moved, who they fought with, and so on. So at least certain aspects of elite life, and as well as their ideology, Maya religion, and so on, began to emerge rapidly, starting particularly by the late 60s, 1970s, up to the present day. And this has led to all kinds of understandings. This is just one very neat one. This is a pot from the site of Rio Azul, has a glyph translated as cacao, the chocolate bean. Probably it was felt was used for cacao drink in the ceremony. The contents of literally the trace elements inside were sent to the Hershey factory in Pennsylvania, and lo and behold, in fact, this pot with a cacao glyph contained the remnants of a chocolate drink. So a nice link between a deciphered glyph and the function of this vessel. And just one of many examples of how the decipherment has given us new insights into ancient Maya civilization. The hieroglyphs, as well as the archaeology, have also shown that the traditional tenet that the Maya were a peaceful people, the old idea of these kind of astronomer kings gazing at the heavens in their jungle stronghold, again, was nice, but probably was simply a myth. Archaeologically, all kinds of indications. This is the site of Bek Khan, with a large wall and moat surrounding the site. A number of other archaeological implications of ongoing warfare, and the hieroglyphs speak of a great deal of raiding among sites, and that warfare and conflict were part of Maya civilization from pre-classic times right up to the conquest. In addition, the view that the Maya were unique and this kind of subjective view of the Maya also has come to an end. Just show this again. This is Sylvanus Morley next to one of the great stelae at Quiriguá. Eric Thompson with a Lacandon Maya taken in the 1940s. And this wonderful picture from the Sinai Chichen Itza
Bradshaw Project, Carnegie Institution of Washington, maybe the first Woody from the 1930s at Chichen, and a number of the writings of Thompson Morley this time indicate the kind of view they held. Morley, for example, loved to make assertions like this, quote, "The ancient Maya loved their children deeply, just as their descendants do today." Well, this is a wonderful sentiment, but we're never going to know that. There's no way to ascertain the veracity of such statements from the archaeological record. Similar things, for example, let me just give you one example from Eric Thompson. He notes, quote, "An interesting illustration of how knowledge of present-day beliefs and customs can be used to interpret archaeological practice came my way some years ago. I found in a votive cache at the summit of a pyramid at the site of San Jose in Belize an incense burner and two bones which turned out to be the ear bones of a manatee. I couldn't imagine why the Maya should have attached ear bones of that queer sea mammal and published the find without comment. Years later, a museum director told me that 60 years ago, he had found that the natives of Maya descent around Lake Izabal in Guatemala regard the ear bone of a manatee strung on a cord around their neck as a magical protection for the wearer. He thought that this was because the manatee's sharp hearing is its best defense. He surely had hit the nail on the head, and from his observation, given the correct interpretation of an archaeological find. And while such an interpretation is surely interesting, and it may well be correct, this is the kind of thinking that characterized traditional, because we have no way of knowing. It was not set up as a testable hypothesis in any scientific manner. And this kind of informal reasoning really highlighted much of my scholarship until very recently. Just one of the wonderful Thompson quote on looking at why Maya civilization, classic Maya civilization, may have collapsed. He notes, quote, "Indeed, every important Maya ceremonial center might be viewed as a sort of tropical Barchester. And on a mural, there is a splendid portrait of Mrs. Proudy watching the bishop at the seat of judgment. Only as long as the right sort were in control did the classic period endure." End quote. Archaeologists such as Thompson Morley and a lot of others in wonderful ways identified with the Maya. But this kind of informal reasoning did not lead to real advancement as Maya archaeology began to expand. And we see more and more of emphasis that the Maya, in fact, were not unique at all, but in fact were very similar in their rise, in their long time development, to other civilizations cross-culturally from both the old world and the new. And perhaps the last major tenet of the traditional focus on the what, where, and when questions instead of why and how also began to change as my archaeologists focused on what led to the rise of classic Maya civilization. And I say a lot of new archaeology concentrating on the pre-classic period, finding that settlements were often found either along rivers or near seasonally flooded swamps, the local bajos, that clearly water and water control was very important. Great sites like El Mirador in Guatemala, with huge complex, in fact, some of the largest architecture anywhere in the Maya world, dating to 300 BC, well before the great buildings at Tikal, Palenque, or Copan. In fact, more and more work in the pre-classic is a site near El Mirador, Nakbe, even earlier, going back 400 or 500 BC, with again some of the largest structures in the Maya area. Archaeologists start looking cross-culturally, find in fact that if you look at major early civilizations, from the Sumerians to the Egyptians and others, the major monumental activity tends to come very early in civilizational history. For example, the Great Pyramids at Giza are early dynasty from the very beginnings of Egyptian civilization. Nothing later, even in the time of Ramses in the Middle Kingdom and so on, do you get this kind of monumentality that you find early. The same is true in the Maya area as well. And perhaps this is related to the investment in the elites of concentrating labor, bringing their uncertain control
better picture that these are not just isolated sites, but we're looking at a large area interacting economically through trade, but also in conflict for land, for labor, for resources. But perhaps the biggest how and why question in the field of Maya studies relates to this kind of key period here between 800 and 1000 AD, and more particularly this century from 800 to 900. This is the question of the causes of the collapse of classic Maya civilization. I've long argued that new understandings of the decline of classic Maya civilization can shed important light on the ability of the ancient Maya to sustain a complex civilization in a tropical forest environment for well over a millennium. In fact, what seems to me the more remarkable is how they were able to sustain an incredible civilization in a very difficult environment for such a long time, over centuries and centuries, that the decline of classic civilization, while interesting, is not, to me, as fascinating as the long development. But that's a whole other question. Classic Maya civilization thrived for centuries with its art, sciences, and economy flourishing until a relatively sudden and dramatic demise around 800 AD, when much of the tremendous building boom ceased, monuments stopped being erected, craft activities and trade routes broke down, and many cities and towns were rapidly populated, with a number of centers being virtually abandoned. However, it should be emphasized that lowland Maya civilization did not end at this time. Rather, the political, economic, and demographic locus of this complex society shifted to the relatively drier northern third of the Yucatan Peninsula, centered around such cities as Chichen Itza and Uxmal. But the southern rainforest heartland of the classic Maya went into a cultural decline from which it never recovered. Even today, the population in the area, with all our modern technology, is far below what it was 1,200 years ago, perhaps by an order of factor of five or more. The demise of classic Maya civilization in the southern lowlands has, through the years, captured the imagination of both archaeologists and the general public alike, in part because it happened when Maya civilization was seemingly at its height. It occurred with great rapidity, and little recovery followed the 9th century demise, at least in the southern lowlands. While the decline of classic Maya civilization was relatively quick, its origins appear to have had much longer roots. Scholars have now identified a series of problems that were intensified or exacerbated during the late classic period, from about 600 to 800 AD. Among the most important trends were environmental degradation, economic changes, rising levels of inner city conflicts, and more arguably increases in malnutrition and health problems. According to recent climatic research, there also appears to have been a significant long-term drought that began at this time in parts of the lowlands. Miners can infer from the archaeological, environmental, and hieroglyphic evidence at hand that the rulers of the Maya city-states were well aware of these problems and took various actions to solve them. In hindsight, in retrospect, however, some of these solutions may have worsened rather than improved these problems. For example, given ancient Maya ideology, one hypothesis would be that if societal conditions went awry, people may have presumed that the gods were angry. And in order to placate these deities and bolster the glory of both the gods and the rulers who represented them on Earth, the latter embarked on programs of major construction and monument carving. But to accomplish such building, they had to take more people away from agricultural pursuits, to provide labor, not only for the building itself, but for all the craft activities associated with monumental construction, quarrying, carving, preparing cement and plaster, and so on. Such actions would have placed even more pressure on an already stressed agricultural sector and may have occasioned even more inner city conflict to provide new labor and additional glory for gods and kings. Growing scarcity of water and wood for construction and for other activities such as cooking fires also caused stress in some regions. Pollen records, for example, indicate that there were no trees at all in various parts of the lowlands by 750 AD. And the consequences of this are not only the lack of wood, but soil erosion and degradation. It's easy to envision how such a cycle of new construction could have left the already vulnerable Maya society even more open to catastrophe than it normally would have been. The onset of a drought, disruption
construction and monument carving just prior to the collapse also makes it clear why Maya civilization appeared to be at its height right before its demise. As a coda to this example, I should note that my reading of possible lessons from the collapse of classic Maya civilization differs from that of Jared Diamond in his recent best-selling book entitled Collapse. After a useful chapter-long review of the Maya collapse, Diamond states, quote, "The passivity of Maya kings in the face of real big threats to their societies completes our list of disquieting parallels," end quote, to the modern world. Clearly, where Diamond sees no action, I see definite actions, but ones that in hindsight probably were not the best. I leave you to judge which analogy to the world today is more worrisome. Let me finish this chronological review by looking now at the post-classic period. The abandonment of Maya cities in the southern lowlands in the 9th century AD did not lead to the end of Maya civilization or its slow decline in the following seven centuries until the Spanish conquest, as traditionally believed. In fact, evidence in recent years supports an argument that the ancient Maya actually flowered after the classic collapse of the 9th century. More than 30 years ago, my colleague William Rathke, then at the University of Arizona, now at Stanford, and I argued that it was time for Maya archaeologists to re-examine the post-classic period, and especially the late post-classic period from about 1250 AD up to the Spanish conquest in the 16th century. More specifically, we contended that the post-classic was a time of growing economic and political complexity, not a period of decline and decadence, as scholars have previously maintained. Furthermore, we argued that the rising growth of mercantile interests played a key role in these developments. In effect, we argued that during this post-classic period, temples, palaces, and ball courts, and sophisticated monumental works of art were not a necessary measure of cultural complexity, and that their presence in the classic period and relative absence in the post-classic did not mean that the post-classic was less complex, let alone decadent, as most Maya archaeologists had traditionally maintained. While some of the details of our arguments 30 years ago have not stood the test of time, I think the general thrust of our perspective has been refined and strengthened by a host of research projects in recent years. We were not convinced that the post-classic was a time of cultural decay. Much of the argument for the late post-classic decadence seemed to be based on perceived aesthetic decline in art and architecture. For example, one Carnegie Institution of Washington scholar, during the time of the Carnegie Project, the last great one in the 1950s at the late post-classic site of Maya Pond, states, quote, "A fact well demonstrated at Maya Pond is that the high cultural standards of the Maya of the classic period had steadily degenerated by the beginning of the 15th century. Stone carving and many of the arts deteriorated," end quote. Another scholar goes on, who shares this view, and states, quote, "that the age was materialistic, that personal comfort and glory came ahead of religious devotion is shown by the palaces and finer residences being better built and apparently more lavishly furnished than the temples and other ceremonial buildings." He also talks about an internal dry rot in Maya culture and further notes, "it is quite clear that Maya Pond fell heir to an impoverished culture," end quote. In regard to the Carnegie Project at Maya Pond, he concludes, quote, "looking at the results of the work as a whole, I think it's been worthwhile, even though we were dealing with a degenerate civilization, devoid of great art, that to all intents and purposes reached a dead end in the Spanish conquest." In reading these analyses of Maya Pond in particular, and the post-classic period in general, Rathke and I began to question one of the key assumptions that underlay post-classic decadence, namely that an apparent decline in aesthetic values was directly related to the condition of the rest of the society. We believe this was based in really on a partial view of Maya civilization that emphasized an elite perspective and all but ignored a non-elite one. And in fact, we went on to state this in more general terms, that at this time, we really see Maya civilization developing, that the earlier kind of dynastic rule, which led to the great centers of the classic period, was replaced by a more mercantile-oriented civilization of the post-classic period. In effect, we archaeological perspective beyond great temples and palaces, which settlement pattern studies had begun to do in the 1950s, a conclusion that the post-classic Maya civilization was not sliding downhill appeared eminently reasonable. Maya civilization clearly was evolving and changing, and post-classic culture was different from the classic, but definitely not decadent. And we did our work in this time on the island of Cozumel, supported by the National Geographic Society, and were able to show that many of these ideas that we held theoretically actually worked when we then examined them. For example, we found evidence of widespread trade. It's a wonderful National Geographic view of a Maya long-distance canoe. And more recently, scholars have actually found remnants of wooden canoes, this one in a cave in Belize. And this underwater, they've actually found a canoe paddle and facilities for Maya trade from the post-classic period. Particularly found that a major commodity of great importance was salt. And although it's perishable, we can begin to trace the trade in salt from dry salt on the shores up here in the north and also along here in Belize as well. In fact, we've now been able to argue that the Maya were engaged in trade closely with almost all of Mesoamerica, especially central Mexico, from before Aztec times right up to the Aztec. Let me close by pointing out that there's a tremendous variety of field research and analyses currently underway in the Maya area. Let me just mention four important sites that you'll be hearing a lot more about in the coming years. The first is that of San Bartolo, just north of Tikal. An archaeological team led by William Saturno has found incredible murals dating back to the pre-classic period. This is about 100 BC, showing a king literally being crowned by the maize god, and good hieroglyphic inscriptions. They've recently found earlier murals dating about 300 BC with a Maya hieroglyphic writing that's early enough that it can't be deciphered. It's a precursor of modern hieroglyphic writing. The great site of Calakmul, and just over on the Mexican side of Mexican-Guatemalan border, also with a team led by Ramon Carrasco, the Mexican government, has found a huge site comparable to Tikal, and growing evidence that Calakmul is one of the great murals that they found. They were one of its great murals, one of its great rulers, was involved in major warfare with Tikal, literally getting other sites, conquering them, and using them to threaten Tikal and actually conquering Tikal for a time during the classic period. An important site of Chunchukmil on the western coast of the Yucatan Peninsula, a project led by Bruce Dahlin here at Howard University in Washington, is finding important economic activity that dates back to the early classic period, way earlier than we had supposed for the Maya ruins at this time. And perhaps last but certainly not least, the major research going on at the site of Copan, the southernmost Maya site, where work there, particularly from the Honduranian government, from the Peabody Museum at Harvard, from Tulane, and from my own museum at the University of Pennsylvania, has shown us a great deal about the nature of Maya rulership and has linked Maya hieroglyphs with the remnants of literally a whole series of rulers. Don't have the time, but they've actually found the remains of the founder of the dynasty, a ruler named Kinichyashkukmo, who ruled first starting in 426 AD at Copan. Here's a portrait of him. We've actually uncovered evidence that he came from Tikal, according to the hieroglyphic inscriptions. Work tunneling into the Acropolis at Copan has revealed a whole series of wonderful buildings, including Yashkukmo's tomb. This is some of his symbolism. Right out of modern forensics, archaeologists are looking at this burial of Yashkukmo.
where the pottery associated with him came through neutron trace element activation analysis, looking at his bones, he actually had an arm broken, probably in battle, a shoulder that never healed, so on and so forth. And this is the burial of his wife covered in cinnabar just above him. And looking at the strontium content of Yashpukmo and his wife's bones, actually able to argument that Yashpukmo came from Tikal, migrated to Copan, and married a woman from a local dynasty. So you have the hieroglyphs, the forensics, the archaeology, all working together to give us a much better view of Copan. Again, I think this is just giving you a little tidbits, but I hope you can see that this is a wonderful time to be studying the ancient Maya past. A decade from now, and especially if we all survive through December 21st, 2012, when some of my New Age colleagues would have us believe that the end of the Great Maya Cycle will also be the end of the world, shades of Y2K. A speaker at a talk such as of this a decade from now will probably be telling you, don't believe what archaeologists like